The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. It's like a second home to me. I'm Monique Moore Pryor, the new executive director of the Free Library Foundation. It is exciting to be here and to take on this role. I'm as a product of two public school teachers, it is my why. It's why I'm here, and to make sure that, yeah, we level the playing field and offer opportunities for our citizens to be here and meet people like Bernie Taupin. Okay. All right. I recently returned to my hometown, as I share, to take this role at the foundation, and what a thrilling time to be here at the Free Library. Tonight marks the start of our fall season opener of the author event series and the Pepper Society season opener. Where are my Pepper Society members? Hey, all right. The Foundation's Pepper Society brings together passionate individuals who share the Free Library's vision of a vibrant and robust library, accessible to all. I thank our members who are here tonight for their ongoing support of the library's mission to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity. And just so you know, I told some people earlier that I made my first donation to the library today, and I hope you'll join me so we can continue to have programs like this and make sure that we increase the literacy in our community and throughout, for our neighbors. We all want that, right? Okay. While the City of Philadelphia provides public funds for the operation of the Free Library, it's your private donations, as I just shared, to the Free Library Foundation that positions the library to be responsive to the ever-changing needs of our communities and make programs like tonight's author event possible. I would be most grateful, as I just shared, if you would consider joining me and my fellow members represented here tonight by making a donation to the Free Library Fund or becoming a member yourself. I'm sure that's a yes, right? Can I get a yes to all of that? Okay, we have lots of different levels, which will help the library continue to offer its transformative resources. I'd like to take a moment to ask everyone to please, what? Silence your phones, yes. And note that no flash photography is permitted during tonight's event. A book signing will follow tonight's conversation, and don't forget that most of our author events are also available as podcasts at freelibrary.org and at youtube.com/author events. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce a real superstar to the Free Library stage. Bernie Taupin is the award-winning and legendary lyricist who has worked with Elton John since 1967, right? I'm so excited. Making them one of the most popular, long-lasting, and critically acclaimed partnerships in music history. Together, Taupin and John are the recipients of a Lifetime Achievement Grammy, an Academy Award, and the John Mercer Award from the Songwriters Hall of Fame, among many other accolades. Taupin has also written songs for a wide variety of other artists, including Rod Stewart, Alice Cooper, and Hart. In 2022, he was made a Commander of the Order of the British Empire for services to music. And this year, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. His new memoir, Scattershot, is about life, rock and roll, and collaboration, and goes inside the story of the famously private writer's art struggles, and friendships. Joining him on the stage is acclaimed singer and songwriter, author Wesley Stace. We are so pleased to have him with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Bernie Taupin and Wesley Stace to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
How's everybody? Yeah. All good? All right.
Here's from your book, Scattershot. Books are beautiful things. Like vinyl albums, books are both comforting and reassuring. They command respect and cannot be bettered by alternatives. Trying to substitute either one with a flashier form of technology diminishes the comfort they bring and only leaves you with a sterile counterfeit representation. Here we are in an incredible house of books, the library. We all have memories of libraries when we were kids. I was really into the literary aspect of this memoir. Books very important to you, from epic poetry, and it all fed into your lyrics. So since we're in a house of books, why don't we start off talking about books? What are your earliest memories of those inspirations that in the end turned out to feed into your lyrics?
Well, I definitely have to give credit to my mother, who was a voracious reader, and so was my grandfather, my parental grandfather. Books were of major importance in my growing up, and as I say, I have to give them credit for that. But the first thing that I really recall more than fiction, well, it was fiction, but was narrative poetry. I was definitely fed narrative poetry from a very early age. Things like Tennyson, Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome. They were actually like my comic books. You know, they because they told stories and they were full of adventure, things like Alfred Noyes, The Highwayman, which was so dramatic and wonderfully evocative. And as I say, they told stories, and that was the basis of everything that came after. Yeah, I read a lot of sort of fiction. I mean, I did eventually, but I think that came later on. I was really, really enamored and engrossed in narrative poetry. And it's like when all the other kids would, and this goes back to being very young, and as I say, they were like comic books, and that's what my games would be. You know, everybody else was playing cowboys and Indians and cops and robbers, and I was Lochinvar, I was Horatius, you know, defending the bridge against the Tuscan horde. And that's why I was very solitary, because all the other kids thought I was completely nuts.
Presumably the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner was
of course,
in there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Not so much, because that was sort of, it was like a bit like Moby Dick, you know, it was kind of endless in the same area. The other thing, as I say, the things I like were things that really, you could hear the armor clang and the shots ring and the swords crashing against shit. I just loved the noise of narrative poetry was really invigorating to me.
Did your mother read it to you, and did you learn it to recite it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a
point. Can you still remember it?
An upspake great Horatius, the captain of the gate, to every man upon this earth, death cometh soon or late. And how may a man die better than facing fearful odds by the ashes of his fathers and the temples of his gods? Winston Churchill loved that too.
I think you're going to say Winston Churchill wrote that for a second.
He probably did. But no, actually, apparently Winston Churchill was very, very enamored with that poem too. So got that in common with Winnie.
Did any of that, I know school wasn't a, you know, at the front of your imagination.
No.
But didn't that... didn't your love of that stuff feed into English classes and stand you in good stead and make that more enjoyable for you?
Well, the thing about school was where I went to school and when I went to school, I went to what they called at that particular, in that era, was called secondary modern. When, if I need to explain that because I think it's important. Yeah. You know, when you, in the 50s and early 60s, you went to what they call primary school, and when you were 11 years old, you took what was called the 11 plus. And if you were dumb like me, you went to secondary modern. And if you were clever like my brother, you went to grammar school. But if you went, and if you went to grammar school, you were lucky because you really got taught. Unfortunately, when you went to secondary school, you really got taught nothing. You got taught the basics, but there was really no interest in the teaching system. It was really just a holding pen from the time you were 11 years old to the time you were 15 years old, and then they just turfed you out. And where I came from, you either sort of basically went to work in a factory or on a farm. You weren't given any choices, basically. So, my teachers were my, you know, my parents and my grandfather, especially, as I said, my mother and my grandfather. And that's how my, you know, one of the opening lines in one of the first chapters in the book, it says, I learned absolutely nothing in school. Everything I learned was from my mother and my parental grandfather.
Bit of a Bruce Springsteen vibe, that.
Yeah, what's the line? I busted out of class, had to get away from those fools. I learned more from a 3-minute record than I ever learned in school. That's actually my favorite Bruce Springsteen line.
It's modern epic poetry. And then another big influence, as everybody here knows, another big influence has been the movies.
Yes.
Particularly American movies.
Right, right.
And, you know, Westerns. What is your first... I know you're a bit of a scholar of the cowboys and stuff. What's your first...
Obsessive, I would say.
Right. So what's your first... You know, what do you remember being so liberating about that?
Well, I think you have to tie it in with the first kind of country music that I heard and listened to, because they kind of go hand in hand. And before the genre of Westerns came into my life, they came in sort of at the same time, but the first things that really touched me and turned me on and made me want to be a songwriter, contemporary pop at the time was great, and I loved that, and I grew up like everybody else with, you know, the basic rock and roll, Chuck Berry, Eddie Cochran. Where I grew up, Elvis didn't really mean anything because people weren't that familiar with him. They were more familiar with people that toured, you know, the Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly. Eddie Cochran was huge where I grew up. And I loved all that, but I loved it just as a contemporary fan. But when I heard, I just stumbled upon narrative, again, it's the narrative sort of cowboy music, and I don't mean sort of country and what they called country and western back then, which they it was on the radio. I mean, they had, but it was all people like Slim Whitman and Jim Reeves and Eddie Arnold, Roger Miller, which, you know, is good in its own field. But it was when I heard people like Johnny Horton and Marty Robbins, you know, Johnny Horton, Battle of New Orleans, Sink the Bismarck. And then when I heard Marty Robbins' El Paso, it was like, you know, it just blew the roof off for me. You know, it lit the blue touch paper, and just, and because it was, again, it was like narrative poetry. They were telling stories, and it wasn't sanitized kind of Western stories. It wasn't the Lone Ranger. It wasn't Gene Autry. It wasn't sort of embroidered shirts and pearl-handled pistols. It was dusty. It was dirty. It sounded like the real thing. And what later, you know, and then from that, I sort of, at the same time, saw some John Ford movies. And I was never a John Wayne fan. I always found him very wooden. But the Vistas were really good. And as time went on, and much later on, obviously Sam Peckinpah came along and blew everybody out of the water, because he was doing the kind of things that I was hearing and seeing in my mind in those old Marty Robbins songs. You know, I mean, the first album I ever owned was Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs, Marty Classic. Robbins' album. And I still have it on my jukebox, and I probably still listen to it once every couple of weeks. And it still takes me, you know, on an adventure. I mean, because all of those songs were not fabricated. They weren't synthetic. They were real blood, sweat, and tear songs. And that and not the band. I don't mean that. So, yeah, they all kind of went hand in hand. So it's sort of, it just evolved that way. And the thing about when I heard, I don't know if I wanted to write songs because I didn't know what writing songs meant. But Marty Robbins, certainly, if I'm going to credit anybody for making me want to write stories, certainly. I think the thing is that when I heard that, I went, oh, you can tell stories and make songs out of them. So that's really sort of it in a very big nutshell.
And funnily enough, one of my first memories is of either country music or westerns is Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling.
Oh, yeah, well, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, I mean, High Noon. Actually, I think High Noon was the first Western that I ever saw.
Yeah, me too.
That I really, not the first Western I ever saw, but the first Western I ever saw that I went, oh, this is more like it. And I just adore the character of Will Kane. I mean, it was, Gary Cooper was unbelievable. He was so stoic and everything the frontier marshal was supposed to be.
Yeah. You know, I'm not trying to do this chronologically or anything, but obviously you made that big move to the big city.
Sure.
When you decided you didn't want to hang around the farm.
Well, there was nothing there. I mean, you had to do that. If you wanted to make any, if you wanted to crack out of that shell, that sort of embryo, whatever you want to call it, of what you were supposed to do where I grew up. You know, as I say, the opportunities were less than limited. I mean, when I went to see the what they used to call the youth employment officer, I'm sure you remember that, they really just, all they were doing was just saying, okay, well, I've got a job driving it. You can get a job driving a tractor on this farm, or you can get a job digging ditches over and somewhere over here. And then if you want to go into the city, we've got factory jobs. And I just didn't want to. I mean, I did it, but I got to the point where I went, I just can't spend the rest of my life doing this. I got to take a leap of faith.
No, I don't know about that, by the way, because like your maternal grandfather, I went to Cambridge. There were no youth. I just wanted to clarify that. So to get away from the farm, you had, you know, I think people may or may not have read the book, but let's take it that a lot of people are au fait with the fact that you met a guy called Reg Dwight.
Right.
You cut demos together, then finally people covered your songs. Then somebody said to you,
not many. No, I have to tell
no,
you.
No. But now, but then somebody said, you know, why don't you write kind of what's in what you want to write,
exactly,
rather than trying to make cookie cutter things,
yep,
that other,
sure,
people can.
Sure.
And then, and so I'm leaping forward a bit.
Yeah.
Then you and he became a, you know, you wrote a hit. You came to America. America was your first place of acceptance,
sure,
in the world. And your, you know, you had your face on, you know, the covers of these, the sleeves of these records. And I just think it's so interesting. I mentioned to you backstage that,
right,
you know, on Procol Harum's records, you know, Keith Reid was on the cover of every,
right,
one,
sure,
like he was a band member,
sure,
Pete Brown and Cream.
Right.
Even
Pete,
you know,
Sinfield and King Crimson.
Pete Sinfield,
you're,
and,
right,
King Crimson,
yeah,
who you reserve special interest and,
yeah,
praise,
sure,
for in,
yeah,
here. Just tell us about that moment, because it, nowadays when it takes 73 producers to write a song, you know, and the sampler and the, you know, there is no concept of actually, well, there's a writer's strike now, so you can't do it at all, but just tell us about that incredible cultural moment when, you know, the people, the songwriters, the word writers were considered as big,
yeah,
as stars as the band, if you like.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I don't think that exists anymore. I mean, I can't think of any examples nowadays of the same kind of thing happening. Yeah, I mean, back then, especially when we started out in the late 60s, there did exist a situation of people like Procol Harum, where there was a guy called Keith Reed who just wrote all the lyrics, and everybody knows White a Shade of Pale, and that was one of the sort of the bigger of the hits that we aspired to. When we were younger, we thought that these guys, this is, I'd like to be doing what they're doing. And again, you know, with Pete Sinfield, with when King Crimson came along a little bit later on, writing things like In the Court of the Crimson King, you know, which I thought, ooh, this is, you know, this is kind of in my wheelhouse here. These are the kind of things I'd like to be doing. There was a guy called Pete Brown who was writing all the all the lyrics with, I think it was with Jack Bruce and Cream. So the lyricist was fair, and as you say, Pete Brown wasn't on the Cream album covers, but I think, was Pete Sinfield part of the band? He was actually in King Crimson, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I mean, but even most recently as the last King Crimson tour, I asked Robert Fripp about one of the lines. He said, well, Pete Sinfield said we had to sing it a different way because he changed it, and we had to. So they had to update 21st Century Schizoid Man.
There you go.
Please,
well,
Pete Sinfield.
23rd century.
Well, what I was going to ask about that was, you know, it's quite famous about Procol Harum, for example, that Keith Reed would never hear anything from Gary Brooker about the lyrics. He would not ask what they meant or anything at all. He would just produce the incredible tune lyric.
Right.
And they had no... there was never a line change, more or less. But I understand that not to have been the case with you and Elton, because there was a bit more give and take in terms of you suggesting how it might sound.
Well, no, I don't think so. Not that came much, much later on, because I think when I first started out, I mean, I was definitely flying by the seat of my pants, because I really didn't know what a songwriter entailed. When I was really young and I heard records, I thought that the person on the record just made it up. You know, I didn't know anything about the people that were underneath the title in parentheses. I never understood what that meant. I didn't realize that those were the people that wrote the song. So I was a complete novice. I had no idea how to create a song. So when I answered that ad back in 1967, I was really sort of just fobbing my way through, if you would. You know, it's like I literally didn't know how to construct a lyric. So incidentally, all of the things that I sent in when I first sent in the first envelope full of, I don't know even what you would call it. It was just sort of stream of consciousness. I mean, there was no formation to it. So the fact that they actually picked it up and sort of he gave it to Elton, or Reg as he was back then, is mind-bending. I mean, I've no idea. I'm sure I was the only person that had sent anything in. I mean, the mystique that, you know, Ray Williams pulled out my, you know, set of lyrics from a whole set of lyrics is complete bullshit.
Right.
You know, because there's no way that when all those people sent, you know, things in, most of them would have been cassettes and tapes and things like that. There was definitely not, you know, a whole slew of people sending in lyrics.
And was that the package you sent to Liberty then?
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but as things progressed, would, you know, you may or may not have been around for all the recording sessions, you know.
Well, I was present at pretty much everything we ever did.
Were you changing lines on the fly?
No. Everything.
I'm really asking about the kind of collaborative process after you've handed over a lyric and Elton's gone, that's a good one, this Yellow Brick Road one.
Yeah, but that's later on, you see.
Sure,
so I was growing up. I was becoming studio savvy. I learned how to construct lyrics. But back in the early day, I was, as I say, I was very green. And I didn't know how things worked in the studio. So I wasn't gonna say boo. You know, it was, I just sat in the back and let them get on with it. But what Elton would do in the very, very early days, I mean, as I say, it was very stream of consciousness. So he might edit it to put it in a framework that was a certain, you know, a sensible length. You know, because probably if he'd done the whole thing, it would have lasted for 10 minutes, you know. So he probably took the best of it out of there. But I didn't make suggestions back there. I was too naive. I was too unversed in songwriting. So that came much later on. I mean, by the time when you mentioned something like Yellow Brick Road, by that point in time, I was presenting material that had a, you know, a sensible meter to it, and it was more in the form of a real lyric. But even then, I wasn't saying, I don't think I had any kind of melodic structure in mind. I just was literally back then just writing a lyric. But as I became more musically proficient, then yeah, I would have and it's like now, and I have for the last probably 30 years, you know, I play like chords on a guitar and just have my own melodic idea.
And rhythm.
Yeah, it gives the lyric a rhythmic sense. But I don't carry that through to Elton. When I give it to Elton, right. I don't say, oh, I hear this, as I've got a melody for this. I would never, that would be treading on dangerous territory. And I don't mean that he would be angry, but he's obviously got a far better melodic sense than I do. So I'm not going to get in the way.
But you, I think I read somewhere you might say, you know, I heard this one as a bit of a reggae feel, kind of thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we've made albums where, you know, we've tried to emulate and do pastiches of classic genres, and I've said, well, you know, this I feel could be sort of a Ray Charles feel to it, you know. Yeah. But again, a lot of the titles of the songs dictate, the structure of the song dictate whether, you know, what the tempo is going to be like. I always say, if you give somebody a lyric like Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, you know, it's not going to be a ballad.
Yeah, right.
And likewise, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me is not going to be sound like Chuck Berry.
Right, yeah. It's a very interesting memoir in that it is, well, to start with, at the top of the book you say you don't really know how you do what you do.
No.
Which is quite a classic songwriter thing to say.
Right.
Quite a good defense mechanism.
It's a good way of getting out of a question.
Yeah, here I am. But, in fact, I found the book to be very clear, really, on many of the things that have caused you to write songs.
Sure.
Although, for example, I know, you know, your song, you famously say you don't quite know what actually inspired it, though you do remember actually writing
Absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I found the book actually to be full of good little scraps. As a would-be songwriter myself, I was interested in that aspect of it. When did you really feel, and perhaps you never did, but I bet there was a bit when you felt, oh, we're really getting somewhere now. This is actually where we want to be going now. What do you remember when that moment?
Yeah,
was?
I think that happened. Definitely with your song,
right.
and probably prior to that, what we were doing, and again, I think it's like any form of the arts. It's like making movies or painting. You start out by emulating, you know, the people that you respect, or emulating your heroes or people that have inspired you. But you get to the point where you go, well, yeah, now I've got to find an original voice. You know, I can't keep doing things that sound like or look like, or as in movies, look like, you know, what other people are doing. Got to find an original voice. And I think the first time we did that, Because, as I say, all those very, very, very early things were all, again, pastiches of what was currently popular. But we ended up writing a song called Skyline Pigeon.
Right.
Which is very... thank you. was written very early on, and it was due to a guy called Steve Brown who came to our publishers. I think he was brought in as sort of a token hippie, you know, because they needed somebody who looked cool in the office, you know. And he gravitated towards us and basically said, why are you guys writing this shit over here? You don't want to be doing that. You know, it's not even good. But I like this stuff you're doing over here for yourself, which was the more, you know, hip kind of writing. He just said, quit doing this MOR stuff, you know, and start writing more like this. Go away and really work on that. And the first thing we did was we came back with a song called Skyline Pigeon, which is, you know, still a little naive, but it has a nice sort of sense of metaphor to it. And we went... And funnily enough, that was the first song that two people within the next couple of weeks did covers of it. And they were the first real covers we ever had. So that was obviously gratifying to us, and it was a step in the right direction. But I think when we came up with your song, we did both. I mean, obviously we had no idea that it would be, you know, have the legs that obviously it has had. But we did kind of go, ooh. This is something special. This is really different. So yeah, that would be in the long way around of giving you your answer.
So, I mean, it's quite surprising to me in a sense. I realized that you were the composer of the songs equally with Elton John, but there isn't necessarily a place for you to be in the studio, and there isn't necessarily a place for you to be on the road. Though obviously you were supporting your very good friend. Sure. When did you kind of stop doing that? Or did you? I mean, presumably you're not on every date of an Elton John
good
world
Lord, no.
So when
no.
did you finally go, I don't need to be there for this?
Well, the thing is that when we first started, you know, in 1967, and those first few years before 1970 coming here, you know, we shared an apartment together. Right. You know, we actually lived with his mother.
Yeah.
In the suburbs of London. And... you know, so we were basically joined at the hip. Everything we did together. And as it right. says in the book, you know, we were an army of two. It was me and him against the world. You know, we had friends, but it was really all about the two of us. And we were like, you know, we were like surrogate brothers. And that continued up to the point that we came to the United States and we played at the Troubadour, the famous gig there. But, you know, that it didn't all explode then. You know, we came back to England and back to our yeah. apartment and our bunk beds in, you know, his mother's apartment. So, you know, the Troubadour may be, have a legendary bent to it, but it's, you know, there was a lot of work after that. And we came back to the States, we came to New York, and we came to Philly. And, you know, we were still great friends. We did everything together, but we were growing up, and so as you grow up, you start your own life. You know, you find other interests and you go in different directions. And you know, we were still bonded musically and as friends, but that's when we started to develop our own lives. And you know, that's only natural. That makes sense. And so, I probably toured, you know, through to 1972, I'd go on all the tours. But then, you know, I discovered that I needed to have a life of my own.
Well, let's talk about what you did discover, because this book is a book of anecdotes. It's crowded with great anecdotes, and it's a book of excess in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, right?
Yes.
There's quite a lot on
many different levels.
There's a lot of partying going on in the book.
Yes.
I mean, deny it if you like. I've just read it. And also another great thing about this book, which if anybody, if when you read it, you will enjoy. My classic note here says, you're certainly not afraid to call a dick a dick. And I mean, there are some very, you know, sacrilegious words about some fairly you know, historically popular people, but who were, you know, you came across a lot of drunks and a lot of people out of their minds on drugs in the pages of this book.
Yeah, the thing is that, I mean, there are points in our life when we're all kind of assholes at one point in time or another, you know. But the thing is that that can be temporary. But then again, there are certain individuals that their assholedom never ceases, you know. So, but I think the thing about in the book, you know, yeah, I call people out. The one thing I can't stand is bullies. And I mean, you know, I've met several in my life, and you know, you'll have to read the book to find them out. But yeah, I'm not afraid. I think people in memoirs tend to, as you said backstage, pussyfoot around.
They do.
You know, they tend to be too nice, and you know, I have no problem in calling people out if I feel they have qualities that are less than gracious. You know, and I've met a lot of people, but by the same token, if I meet somebody who leaves a lasting impression on me, I'm going to go the complete opposite direction and lord them from the rooftops.
And of course, those things come in the same package.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't, you know, some geniuses it's mix and are match. Not lovely people.
Absolutely,
you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, as I say, people sort of dance around the truth. And one of the things that I cannot do is lie. There's too much lying today. Everybody thinks it's become sort of an accepted vice. And I'm not willing to be a part of it.
Well, and also, I mean, you came to America presumably as a fan of the old mythic America.
Right.
And the Western America and the America of the country and Western. And now, you know, 2023, you now live in a very different America indeed.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, but it's still an America I love, you know, and I see the right and wrong and the good and the bad, but you know, what can I say? I mean, I live in a very blessed part of the country. I live where there are great, great individuals and really decent people, and that's the people I have no problem with.
Do you go into writing a song? I know that, like many songwriters, and you know, you write down titles, and I think anybody looking at the back covers who doesn't know the songs on an Elton John album, looking at the titles alone is incredibly exhilarating. Because, you know, you just see, when I was a kid, you know, I remember looking in like at the back of Yellow Brick Road and seeing those titles.
Right.
And, you know, that, you know, the one with the, you know, the line. And it's just like, it was incredibly. And so tell us about obviously you can't pin it down, but what is it about that title that just makes you go and then come back? Presumably you have a list of them.
Well,
like,
yeah,
I
but
do
the
on
thing,
my phone, and then you go back to them and
right,
you see.
Right. That goes back to when I started buying records when I was a kid, and even, you know, sort of into the early 70s, when I went into a record store, in the days when you can go at a record store and, you know, thumb through albums. Albums that would appeal to me, not just the covers, you know, obviously covers were very important, but if I'd flip it over and I'd look through the titles, you know, if you look through a sort of a Laura Nero album and you look through the titles, you'd see great titles, you know. So that would really appeal to me, it much more so than something that has sort of generic, you know, bland titles to them. So I was inspired, you know, I would buy those records simply on that alone. And so titles have always been very important to me. And, you know, it's usually the first thing that comes up when I write something. I usually scribble down titles all the time and put them in my phone, you know, and when it comes to writing a song, they're the sort of basis of what comes next. But what was your exact question? I'm sorry, you were asking me. See, I go off on, as I say in the book, I go off on tangents. So, but
what was the exact question? God, I don't remember. well, we don't even need to come back to it. It's a perfectly satisfactory answer.
But no, they are. Titles are very important.
But that was it. It was just about the
title. And you
were
saying something about the Yellow Brick Road album, which, again, you know, I always think it's interesting that the Yellow Brick Road album, there isn't really one love song on it whatsoever. Yeah. They're all like mini movies.
Yeah.
They're all stories about sort of tarnished individuals and the seedier side of life. And as one journalist once said, it's one of the filthiest albums ever made.
We are going to go to questions in a moment, after one more question of mine. And I suggest there will be quite a few questions about Elton. So, and, you know, which, fair enough.
Who's but, he? Elton who? Yeah.
But what I want to ask is I want to ask, finally, about the book. Now, I know you did write a memoir of your youth much earlier on.
Yeah, in the 80s.
Right, and I just wondered, you know, what it was. I know you told me backstage that you really enjoyed doing this, but just tell us a little bit about why you wanted to do it now, how you got it done, and what the process was like of doing it.
Yeah, well, I think it's obvious that I did it now. I mean, I'm 73 years old. It makes sense to write a memoir sort of at this particular point in your life. You're not going to write it when you start out, and there's not much point in writing it when you're in the middle of your career, because that's not to say
that's a very old-fashioned attitude. People write one at every stage of their career.
Well, not me. That's never been my... No. So it just makes sense to do it now. I mean, I've got to a place in my life where I'm very settled. I've still got a lot to say and a lot to do, but those adventures that are in that book are very much behind me. And so, I felt it was the perfect time to do it. But it wasn't obvious at first. It wasn't an obvious thing that I didn't say, I'm going to sit down and write a book now. I'd written a magazine article for Bazaar magazine that I'd been asked to write, and I really enjoyed doing it and the process of doing it. And so after that, I ended up writing a few more sort of, I guess they're chapters, but they were more like short stories about my life and vignettes. And after I'd written three or four of them, I went... I guess what I'm doing here is writing a book.
Right.
You know, so I took it seriously and signed up with my agent in New York, and we got a deal. And then I basically went into it in all seriousness, and for 2 years, you know, just worked every day, a couple of hours a day, and came up with 800 pages.
Which
we had to obviously edit down severely. But I'm proud of it, you know, no ghostwriters. I wrote every word of it myself. And thank you. but I had a very, very good editor who, you know, we managed to get it down to a readable length. And it was a very liberating prose.
Was there anything you found it hard to write about? I mean, were there any bits that were noticeably harder in the writing about them, or did you not feel any awkwardness?
No, none whatsoever. What it did do was I would be writing about a specific time, and what would happen was I'd start remembering things that I hadn't remembered before. So the actual writing of it really conjured up things that I'd forgotten about. So it was good. It was almost like being on the couch and being psychoanalyzed, you know, because I came up with things that were sort of hidden in the recesses of my very bizarre, weird mind.
And much more cost-effective than actually having an actual therapist. Okay, so I do have some questions.
Okay.
I know the answer to the first one. But I will not allow you to answer.
Leader Karnak.
I know that it's one of the most overinterpreted songs that you've ever written, and I know there's a missing third verse that may or may not make it any more clarifiable. But the question here from an audience member is: who is Daniel, and who was it written for?
Okay, well, that's all in the book, and it's made very clear. But
well, he might not have read it yet.
Having said that, it's not any secret because it's out there. I mean, if you go on the internet, I mean, I wrote that song after reading an article in Time magazine on a plane about the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, and it's about a Vietnam vet escaping the people that sort of lauded him back home. When the vets returned from Vietnam, depending on where they went, I think when they went to the sort of more metropolitan areas, they were sort of spat on and regarded as sort of baby killers and what have you. But when in the Midwest, they returned to a sort of hero's welcome. So it's supposed to be about a character who goes home and just can't take the complimentary life that he's afforded when he goes home. So he just takes off to a place that he found solace in years before. I mean, that seems long and involved, but that was the idea of the song. And as for the mythic third verse, it actually just turned up recently. So it's just more of the same. It's just not a very good verse, and we just cut it out. So there's no great secret to that. But yeah, it's his younger brother just saying farewell to him.
And which leads me on to the next great question. Is there indeed a third verse to Daniel that was left off the recording? So that's that one.
You were going to ask if I wrote Lucy in the Sky with Doc. That's a private joke between them.
That's true. No, but what I was going to ask is, do you remember where the name Daniel popped up from, the actual name Daniel?
No, it wasn't based on any real person. So it was just something that probably sounded good melodically. You know, it has a nice cadence to it, Daniel, you know. It's better than Frederick.
Right. Tell that to Patti Smith. She had quite a good song called that.
Did she?
Yeah. Please tell us about your lyrics to Philadelphia Freedom.
No.
It has a deep resonance for some of us in Philadelphia, all of us in Philadelphia.
How surprising.
Yeah, I can't think why that is. Well, tell us about it.
Okay, well, that's an easy one. Elton and I were very, and still are, very good friends with Billie Jean King, and Billie Jean King had a tennis team called the Philadelphia Freedoms, and sorry, I just thought of something. And Elton had the idea. Well, no, Billie Jean said, "Oh, if you ever think, you know, ever feel like doing it, would you write a song for the team?" I'm sorry I have to say this, but Elton says, there's no fucking way I'm going to get Bernie to write about tennis. So I compromised, and I said, well, why don't we do something that just kind of salutes Philadelphia in general and America in general, you know, like something that's anthemic. And at the time, the Philly sound was really, really prevalent, too. All those great records that Gamble and Huff were doing out of Philly. So again, we sort of, that's really how it came about. And it's kind of a salute. You know, it's a general salute to the city, but I think it could work for any city. But yeah, it was definitely not about tennis.
When you think back to all these great songs, so many of them must get put before you. You know, like Daniel or Philip. You know, they must get Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. They must get endlessly mentioned. Are there, what's a song of yours that you really think is a cracker on one of the classic albums, say, that kind of just slips by all the time? And you think, I wonder why people don't ask me about that, because that song's so great.
Well, yeah. Number one, I don't know what a classic album is. I mean, you know, the thing is, the stigma is that all those albums from the 70s are all our classic albums, which I don't necessarily agree with. I don't think they're all that great. I don't mean all of them. I'm saying there are some of them that are
better
not as
others.
Great as I think people think there are, and there are albums that we've made since then that are much better than those. I mean, things like, you know, Rock of the Westies and Caribou, they're all right. They've got a couple of good songs on them, but there's a lot of filler on them. Whereas I think albums like Songs from the West Coast, The Diving Board, you know, they're far, far better albums than those two albums. But, you know, that's all a matter of taste. But people, I think it's because they grew up with them, they think they're sort of classics. But okay, what do I think's a cracker?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what a song that I think is probably one of my favorite songs we've ever written is Sacrifice.
Right. It's a
fantastic song. But there are other ones. I mean, I Want Love, This Train Doesn't Stop There Anymore. Those are songs that I really love. Maybe it's because you don't hear them as much, but they resonate with me. And I think all the other things that, you know, people talk about are songs that you hear all the time. And I'm glad I hear them all the time, but you hear them in the supermarket, you hear them in the elevator, you hear...
That's annoying.
It's when I don't hear them, I'll start worrying. But I've heard them so much, they don't resonate with me, as I say, the same way as those songs I mentioned just now.
I suppose that some of the, just to follow up on what we're actually talking about, I suppose that some of the reasons they're called classic albums is purely because they are from the classic album era. You know what I mean? That's why, at a time when kind of rock was at its pinnacle,
well, I think
now
it's
there's
also,
too much of everything,
but
and
I think it's
no
also,
one can pay attention, and it's difficult.
Yeah, it's also about the time period that people grow up with them. It's, you know, here's the thing. I mean, people always like the music of the era they were raised in. I mean, back when we were kids, you know, people that were raised in the 30s and 40s would say, oh, I love the, you know, there's nothing like the old big band music. And then in the 50s, you know, people from the 50s say, there's still nothing better than Buddy Holly and Elvis, and, you know. And then hence the 70s, they say the same thing about us. There's great music in every decade and every generation. People that say, you know, there's no good music like there was back then, now, that's rubbish. I mean, there's always great music.
Oh, good.
There's kids out there making, you know, who are incredibly talented, and to say there's no good music now is an insult, I think.
One of my, not my, his or her, favorite songs is Take Me to the Pilot. Elton has said he has no clue what the lyrics mean.
That makes two of us. That's the answer to that, sorry.
Yes, he asks for insights, but I'll just move on.
Whatever you want it to be.
In the mid-2000s, now this is a good question. Oh, because we haven't talked about your horses at all.
Oh, right.
So in the mid-2000s, we saw your bull, Rocket Man, in Philadelphia at a bull riding competition. What made you interested in raising bulls and bull riding?
Okay, well, first I have to answer. Rocket Man wasn't my bull. There was a Rocket Man, but it had nothing to do with me. I had a bull called Little Yellow Jacket, which was a 3-time world champion bucking bull, 3 years in a row. But I got into the PBR, which is the Pro Bull Riders, through cowboying, you know, when I, in the early 90s. And it was just a gravitational thing. I just made friends with these guys and became very involved with it and became their sort of celebrity spokesman, I suppose it was. But it was a lifestyle I just loved. And I was gratified to have a piece of this bull who was an extraordinary animal and one of the greatest bucking bulls of all time. So, it just went hand in hand with everything I did, cowboying.
Just a quick one from me. Has there been a time when Elton has said to you, oh, I would like a lyric about
I thought
some...
you were going to say, I like to go bull riding.
No. Well, that's a more important question, possibly.
Sorry.
No, totally. Don't worry. But has he ever said, you know what, I've been thinking about this or this kind of thing, or I have a song that... Could you give me a lyric with this story or about that thing? Or and it does, have you ever kind of had... Has he ever given you commissions, as it were?
Not per se. I mean, he's had ideas, but not necessarily for specific songs. I don't recall him ever saying, "Can you write a song about such and such?" What he was more apt to say was, "I'd like to do an album that has this kind of feel to it." You know, like whether it be an album that has more up-tempo songs. We did an album recently called Wonderful Crazy Night, and he wanted to do songs that were sort of a little bit more poppy and up-tempo, and I think he felt that there was too much negativity out there, so he wanted to do something that was more positive. I mean, I'm not sure it ended up being one of our better later albums, but yeah, those are the kind of things, some of the albums where he would say, "I'd like this album to have sort of a real R&B soul feel to it."
Right.
When we did Peachtree Road, you know, we wanted to do an album that sort of, you could feel a little of the soul of the South and, you know, smell the magnolia blossoms and talk about things like that. And I think that worked to a certain extent. I think that was pretty good. So yeah, it's more about a feel as opposed to particular subject matter.
I've been told we've only got time for one more. And
do we have another couple of questions?
We do.
Yeah, let's do.
Well, now that Elton, well, you might not like this one. Now that Elton is retired from touring, are you still writing new lyrics with him?
Oh, I said, well, that, you mean physically with it? No, I know what you're saying. No, I think what needs to be made very clear is that, you know, just because Elton's retired from touring, he's not retired. We haven't retired from the studio. We've still got a lot to say, and we will be going into the studio very soon.
Do you typically, if you don't mind my asking, send him over a lyric you're really happy with, or would you wait until, you know, he said, "I need some," or would you give him a batch altogether?
No. Again, I can make this very clear. I don't write on a sort of daily level. I'm not a sort of professional songwriter. I'm not sort of Diane Warren, who goes into her office every day and writes songs, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. But the only time I ever write is when we are preparing to make an album. Right. And then I'll go in and I'll possibly work for a few months before we're scheduled to record, and I may end up writing anywhere near, you know, 25 to 30 pieces. Not all of that will be used. We'll take that into the studio and he will sift through it. And again, titles, he loves to look. And if there's a title that, you know, makes a mark with him, then he'll go into that. Or he'll look through the song, and if he sees something in the verse or the chorus that strikes him, you know, he'll start working on it. And we'll maybe end up recording, 15 to 18 things. Again, you know, maybe only 12 of those will get used, and then the rest, you know, may be used down the road as bonus tracks. But, yeah, that's how we work. I just to say, I only work now, not in the early days. We just wrote all the time. But, no, I'm only sort of hard at it before the studio calls.
One last question. I loved the Rocket Man movie.
What
did you think of it's odd seeing yourself portrayed on the screen under any circumstances, I should think. What did you think of it?
Well, the thing that is, you know, people ask me that all the time. They say, "Did you like the Rocket Man movie?" And I think people don't realize that Elton's company made it, so sure. We made it.
Sure.
So, of course, I mean, not me personally, but
But still, there's an actor pretending to be you.
Yeah, no, that's kind of odd, but it wasn't as odd as I thought it was, because I thought Jamie did a great job. And the thing is that, you know, I got to see the script all the time. I got to say, well, I would never say that, or I would never do that. And that was gratifying. It was wonderful. And, you know, we had complete freedom to say whatever we wanted or do whatever we wanted with the film. So, yeah, I mean, it was all okayed by us. And as far as the portrayal, I loved the portrayal. And it's funny because the movie is a fantasy and the music is all over the place chronologically. It doesn't happen in the way it did in real life. But the funny thing is there are passages in the movie that are happen exactly as they did. For example, writing your song, that was so spot on. And then also me visiting Elton in rehab was exactly like it happened. So it was great. It was a mixture of true reality and true fantasy, and I think that's the best kind of filmmaking.
Ladies and gentlemen, hold on. I would just like to say what an honor it's been for me to talk to one of the preeminent great rock lyricists of modern times.
Thank
Will you.
You
please give a round of applause
Thank you.
To Bernie Taupin?
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for coming out, Philly.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.